Hello, and welcome to episode 250 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick, and welcome to our 250th episode.
It's the semi-quincentennial episode.
You've been practicing that all week, haven't you?
It's not easy to say. That's why people say 250th.
Most people over the years have worked for both good bosses and bad ones. And the best leaders often seem to share a few qualities. They trust people. They communicate clearly. They give employees room to do their jobs while still providing guidance and input. And the worst leaders often do none of those things. When I think back to my first editor at a small newspaper in Iowa, one thing that stands out is that she had spent years helping young journalists develop. She knew when to teach, when to challenge, and when to step back and let people learn through experience. That got me thinking about a leadership philosophy that, Rick, I know you've spent years studying and teaching, and that's servant leadership. I'll admit that when I first heard that phrase, it sounded admirable, but a little vague. And most people, I think, understand what a leader is, and most people also probably understand what a servant is. But putting those two ideas together can raise some questions. We'll unpack some of that as we go through today's show, but Rick, let's start with the basics. What is servant leadership, and why do so many people believe it's an effective way to lead?
Servant leadership is a phrase coined by Robert Greenleaf in 1970. He wrote a little pamphlet called The Servant as Leader. He had been an executive at AT&T at the time when AT&T was one of the biggest companies in the world. After he retired in 1964, he started the Center for Applied Ethics. As he was working in that center, of course, like you're talking about 1964, 65, 66, there's all this social disruption. People are becoming pretty disenchanted with leadership in this nation. In some ways, it's kind of similar to what's going on in the world today, where there's like real social upheaval. And in times like that, people start questioning traditional modes of leadership. And so he writes this little pamphlet called The Servant as Leader. And it really catches on with a few companies. And it starts growing really by word of mouth. And in it, Greenleaf just says, like, the best leader is a servant first. That is, what is your motivation for leading? Well, it's the privilege of having responsibility for caring for people, for making their lives better, and for making your communities better, making your organization better. So this idea of being a servant first, like that's one's primary motivation. So I'll say this, like the reason why it seems kind of vague is it is. It isn't an articulated strategy. When you're taking care of people's legitimate needs and you're trying to help them get better and help your organization get better, there's lots of different strategies you can employ. Servant leadership is mostly just about this initial attitude that one goes into leadership with.
And I would think in today's world that to some people might sound a little different than what they see in their workplace, but I can imagine in the world of 1970, this probably sounded very different than what many organizations and leaders operated under.
It was revolutionary. And two of the first organizations to buy multiple copies of this little pamphlet by Greenleaf and use them were an order of Franciscan nuns, which that's no surprise.
Yeah.
The other is the U.S. Marine Corps.
Which has a very different, also not a money-making enterprise, but it's certainly a different mission than a group of nuns.
Yeah. But the idea that leaders are there to serve, like, and this is our mission, to serve the nation, and then to serve one another, like, this putting service first was a really great articulation of the kind of leadership that they were trying to teach and to practice.
And I would say that there clearly must be a difference, but I want you to kind of tease it out a little bit, of someone who's being a good servant leader versus like somebody who's just like a nice boss. I mean, we've all had people, we all know nice people. Sometimes they end up in leadership positions, but being a nice boss is different than what you describe, right?
Yeah, and oftentimes nice bosses have a real challenge in with servant leadership because nice people are often conflict avoidant. If you're really caring for a team, you've got to be really firm about what your expectations are, because if you don't handle with the people who are disruptive, who are not just undermining your authority, but undermining other people's ability to do well in an organization, if you are willing to tolerate that sort of thing, you quickly destroy a culture. And I see this lots of times with people who, I mean, let me put it this way. One of the big criticisms of servant leadership is based on this misconception. It's just about being nice. And it's not. Like, caring for people's legitimate needs is incredibly hard to do because you've got to pay really close attention to what those needs are, and then you've got to actually do something about it.
And I want you to talk a little bit about sort of your role in this over your career and how you've taught some of this. But I would imagine that as people come to these sessions and try to become a servant leader, it would seem natural to me that those people sort of sort into two groups, the people who need to be better servants and the people who need to be better leaders. Because I don't know if it's exactly 50-50, but you want a good balance there. And like the nice person you mentioned is probably like a good servant in as much that they'll like listen to their employees and treat them well and try to be their advocate. And a good leader may like be able to set a goal and make sure everybody's working toward it, but you know, at what cost? And am I right that a lot of people have a strength in one and maybe a weakness in the other when they show up to these sessions that you lead?
I would say just about everybody. And that's typical of all of us. So like the first thing that we do is we say leadership, despite what you might have heard, leadership is not so much about what you do. It's mostly about who you are. You've got to know yourself. What are your strengths that you can really employ really well in a leadership position? What are your weaknesses that are going to cause some problems for you and problems for other people? And you've got to be able to look at that critically and really honestly. I'd like to give an example. There's somebody that both of us know, but our leadership, our listeners from outside of the region might not know, Dave Scogan, who's the founder of Festival Foods. I've heard
which is a statewide, Wisconsin-wide supermarket chain of, I don't know, probably 3-4 dozen stores.
Yeah. So when he was starting out, so his dad had a little neighborhood grocery store. He takes that over and he moves into the supermarket business at a time where, you know, you've got these Cub Foods and these, you know, other big grocery stores, these chains that are just coming along. And he's trying to get into this business. And he starts a couple stores, but he's also kind of struggling with it in some ways because he really knows the grocery business. He's got a great business plan and everything else. He ends up going to a national grocers conference and he hears Jim Hunter speak, who's a servant leadership author and business consultant. He talks to Hunter, and Hunter asks him if he's ever done a 360. Asked, you know, well, what do the people who report to you think about you? And he hadn't. And Hunter says, well, that's where you start. You find out, like, well, what do people really think? One of the questions on there is, like, how well do you listen? And so Dave Scogan is doing this evaluation himself, and he scores himself pretty high. I can't remember what he said, like 7 or 8, but decent as a listener. He gets back the results from the people who report to him, and they all rate him really low. And he's surprised by this. So he's trying to, okay, what do I do about it? That's the question. You can't just change a quality like this through intention. So he takes a number of shirts, and he has the word listen embroidered on the cuff. So every time he looks down to see what time it is, he sees the word listen. This is a way of reminding him he's got to stop. This is the sort of thing I think is a really good example. First of all, listening is a prime characteristic of servant leaders. Like, you don't know what your people are going through if you're not listening to them. But the other thing is, and you've not got to know about yourself. Like, you know, these different qualities are important. Which ones do I do well and which ones do I need to work on?
The one thing that I guess will question about this dynamic is, like I said before, I think we agree that oftentimes people come in really strong on either the servant side or the leadership side and need to build in those skills to sort of balance that out. But when you were talking about Dave Scogin, you just sort of glossed over the fact quickly that he grew up in a family that ran grocery stores. He knew that business well. And clearly, that was, if he was going to succeed anywhere, it was in the grocery business. Doesn't competence also play a role? Because I just can think of people like, you know, if Dave Scogin, this grocery store owner, turned into the world's best servant leader, and then he like quit the grocery store business and went to run a hotel. Maybe that's closer than I think, but maybe even some non-customer focused business. Do you think competence also plays like a key role? Or do you think that if you have those other two, you can learn the third?
No, you're absolutely right. Competence is extraordinarily important. In fact, if you think about an organization, you can picture it like a triangle where the mission is at the top, and down in one corner would be operations, and then down another corner is culture. Servant leadership focuses on culture. And the reason is, you absolutely, to have a successful organization, mission is probably the most important. That's what you do. It's how we think about the organization. So that's incredibly important. Operations, that's competence. That's how you achieve the mission. So those two things are really important. Most businesses, if they are in business at all, are pretty good at both mission and operations. I mean, if they're not good at one of those two things, they're failing.
They won't be in business long.
What most organizations struggle with is the culture part, because that's a matter of, like, how do people feel? It has to do with primarily two things, engagement and trust. And engagement levels historically in American businesses have been really low. Somewhere between 20 and 30% of employees on average say that they are engaged. And you have nearly that high percentage that are actively disengaged. They're being counterproductive in the organization. The other are just riding along. The companies that we find are excelling, that are performing really well. So if you look, for example, on the Fortune 100 list of the best companies to work for, those companies will have somewhere from like 80 to 99% engagement. Like, they're super, super high in engagement. That's where you go from being a company that's struggling all the time and just surviving to standing way above your competitors.
And you went back to this Robert Greenleaf story in 1970 where he came out with this. And I think this was certainly revolutionary, or you said it was revolutionary for that time. I don't know if there's any data on this, but like, if you went back to 1950s or 1960s America, do you get the sense that employees back then felt engaged? Because this was certainly something, a skill set that was really lacking in most workplaces.
So, yeah, engagement goes up and down. We don't have data going back that far. But I would say, coming out of World War II, you would have much higher levels of engagement, because this is a time where a lot of companies are growing. And you tend to have higher engagement in growing companies because people have a lot more autonomy. People get promoted more often. They have more responsibility. What people want, they want their work to be meaningful, and they want to have some say in how they do their job. If you've got those two things, then you've got pretty high engagement. If you couple that with like good relationships with your boss who listens to you, then you've got really high engagement. at that time in our history, like through the 1950s, late 40s, 50s, business is booming. All these new jobs are being created and things. I would say there's probably pretty high engagement. And then you get to this point where, like, you start to reach more of a status quo, and then you've got social forces that really start to disrupt things in the mid to late 60s.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time in the past, but I'm curious on that. I mean, I wasn't in the workforce in 1970, but you think of a culture that, like, you know, the TV show Mad Men, right, which was very patriarchal.
Yep.
And women were not in the workforce in large numbers, and if they were, they held a certain select type of job. And that hadn't changed a lot by 1970, but it was starting to change then. Do you think servant leadership sped that process along, or did Robert Greenleaf and others talk about that early on back then?
A lot of people were talking about it then, and they started to, like, so as women are entering into the workforce, it's hugely disrupted because they're not engaged in the same way. You know, there's a glass ceiling. You can't get promoted. Like, those are engagement issues. We didn't talk about it in those terms in those days, but there's incredible dissatisfaction. And there probably had been more dissatisfaction for a while. It's starting to get voiced in a different way. What happens is, you know, as this pamphlet comes out, and, you know, I talked about, you know, the Franciscan Sisters in the Marine Corps adopts it, but other companies, like Herb Kelleher, who's the founder of Southwest Airlines, he orders a whole bunch of copies. And then Jack Lowe, who had started TD Industries, which is like a commercial air conditioning and heating and air conditioning, they ordered a whole bunch of copies. Well, one of the things that had happened to Jack Lowe is he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. It required him to step back and really reflect on having a shortened life and, like, what is he doing this for? And he's realized, like, he's really created this company for his employees and for his communities to be better. And so, like, he orders copies for all his leaders and has regular discussions. Let's talk about this. What happens is they start taking off as a company. You get all this buy-in. Same things happen with Southwest Airline. They're just a regional, right, airline. And they start growing tremendously through the 1970s and 80s. Well, servant leadership is right at the core. And people are starting to pay attention. Like, what's their secret sauce? Why is this little airline out of Texas, why has that got such dang loyal customers who just love flying their airplanes where everybody else is kind of tolerating the flight experience?
And you mentioned, of course, that in, not surprisingly, that like the 1950s and 60s, we did not have a lot of data about how happy employees were and how engaged they felt. But we have no shortage of that data today. I would imagine when people are, you know, there is also no shortage of, like, how to be a better leader, how to, you know, become more successful in the workplace. There's, you know, you could spend the rest of your life reading books and listening to podcasts and watching TED Talks about such things. What data do you see that really shows that, you know, maybe Southwest Airlines is but one example, but that really shows even to today how these teachings still resonate? And also, maybe relatedly, has the message at all evolved since 1970, or does it really sort of stick to those same roots that were Greenleaf first came up with?
That's kind of complicated because as servant leadership has become more popular. So 25 years ago, when I started teaching this, a lot of people had never heard of it, right? It just sounded like contradictory terms. Most people have heard the phrase, at least by now. And one of the things that happens when a phrase or a term gets this real popular is people start using it to mean all kinds of things. And so when you say, like, has the meaning changed? Well, yeah, people are using it in all kinds of ways. I think those organizations that are serious about servant leadership are still looking back to Greenleaf and still looking at this core idea that it starts with wanting to be a servant first. But they interpret that to mean, that means really paying attention to our culture and the well-being of our people. I would say, like, one of the challenges is, and there's all kinds of new studies coming out, and we got all kinds of data now on, like, and well-being in the workplace and so forth. We know, for example, through some recent studies and meta-analysis, so like all of these well-being initiatives that are real common throughout the corporate world, none of them work. Like, it doesn't really matter what you do. Like, all these initiatives don't really work. What seems to work really well is something where you build relationships. Like, that actually improves people's well-being. But you can't have people going off and do things by themselves. And so, like, as we study it, we look at more data, you need proper kind of motivation. You need really high-quality relationships. People are able to have friends at work, tend to be highly engaged and much more productive. And then they've got to have trust. They've got to have trust in their leaders. Gallup pretty convincingly shows that, like, people who say their manager listens to them regularly, they're four times more likely to have trust in leadership in their organizations. We've got really good data on a lot of this.
And I would imagine that also leads to better retention, right?
Yeah, because that's really the key. So how do you attract and retain good people? And lots of times you can attract people. If you have a company that's kind of well-known and people are living in that region, if you pay enough and so forth, you can get people applying. How do you retain your best people? That's where you really need the high engagement. And if you're not listening to them, you're not going to retain your best people. You are going to retain your worst people because a lot of them aren't going to be able to go somewhere else and get another job. And this is why that culture piece is so important, you know, of the three. If you're an organization that doesn't retain your best people over the course of a few years, you're stuck with a whole bunch of people who couldn't work anywhere else. And then all of your productivity, your customer service, everything just goes downhill.
You mentioned early that some of the earliest adopters with this was an order of nuns, was the Marine Corps, and then small regional airline that grew much larger. Those are pretty different. But we have many other different types of workplaces, you know, from nonprofits to hospitals to sports teams to, you know, we all know that there's tons of different places and different ways people work. Do you get the sense that this servant leadership philosophy works better in certain sectors, or are you convinced that it doesn't really matter what you do? This really kind of overlays almost any workplace.
It most readily and most often gets picked up in the service sector. And then you can understand.
Like the grocery store operator.
The grocery store. So like that kind of retail where people are working directly with customers. Yeah, it gets picked up there. Also like hotels. Also like hospitals, for example. A lot of healthcare systems were early adopters of servant leadership. Where you really don't expect to find it is manufacturing. And that's where I find it has the profoundest effect. We haven't had as many students come through our program that come out of manufacturing, but the people that have are the ones that I have the most amazing stories about of like significant turnarounds in their operations because of servant leadership. And I think it's because the standards for treating employees is maybe much lower, so it's runs counter to expectations. But if you're in manufacturing and you are consulting with people who are working on the factory floor about their working conditions, what they need, and you're trying to make things better for them, they are so grateful. And the other thing is they have great ideas for how to improve things that they're never sharing. I had one people who worked for a large manufacturing company that's in this region. And after his first class, he just started sitting down for lunch with everybody in the factory floor. He was one of the plant supervisors. He started getting all these ideas. And one of those ideas was revolutionary for how they did their production. And he asked his employee, like, how did you think of this? She said, oh, I thought of it about 10 years ago. Hmm. And you're like, nobody ever asked my opinion before.
But you're using that as an example, though. And this really leads into where I wanted to go next, is there's a guy who's, well, assume it's a guy, who's been there 10 years working on in this manufacturing facility, came up with, and we'll also stipulate that if he's been there 10 years, he's probably at least an average or above average worker. And he came up with an idea 10 years ago to make this, you know, better or something better, and nobody ever asked him, and suddenly someone did, and that leader can, you know, make the decision whether that's useful, and it probably is. But I think that people might hear that story and say, well, that just means that good companies are going to look at their frontline employees and say, you know, we have, you know, 50 people working on the manufacturing line in our facility, and I think the people in charge could probably identify the strongest five, the best five workers, the most productive, who we measure in all sorts of ways. And that from that five, we should pick the next two or three that are going to be the next leaders of that manufacturing facility, because they know their jobs well. And they're likely, like the guy you just described, have a great idea to implement and make things better. But at the same time, I can think of plenty of examples in my own life where somebody who's just really good at a job does not necessarily going to mean that they're great at managing other people who do their job. So I guess, how do you sort of balance those two things, right? Is, you know, the best ideas often come from the people doing those jobs, but that may not be where the best leaders come from. Is that both true in both cases?
Yeah, and you've probably heard of the Peter principle, where, you know, like, people get promoted to the level of their incompetence. Because oftentimes in organizations, hierarchical organizations where there's a lot of different levels, you get promoted on the basis of competence. You're doing your job really well, so mm-hmm. you get promoted up to the next level. You might be terrible at relationship building. Because you can do your job really well doesn't mean that you're good at understanding other people, listening to other people. We talk a lot in servant leadership about, like, so what are the real skills that you need to be a good leader of people? And how do you identify and help to develop those? Because you better be thinking about that. If you're a leader in an organization, where's your next round of leaders coming from? Who are you going to promote? And you better know what characteristics to look for.
And as we close here on this topic, I think it's maybe worth circling back to something you said early on. There are times where any leader is going to have to make tough decisions. And that can be, you know, a time of crisis where you have to react quickly and nimbly. It can be, you know, kind of a dysfunctional team where you have to make some difficult decisions about weeding out some poor performers. I mean, there's all sorts of things. For anyone listening to this, I don't want them to walk away from thinking that a servant leadership course is just like how to be a nice guy, but it's also like how to be ready when those tough decisions and kind of unexpected challenges come along.
Like making those tough decisions, and you have them, like in business, like, how do you prepare for them? Well, you have to have a firm understanding of what's most important and what's secondary. You know, like, you're, when things are going well, you can do a lot of different things. When you have a crisis, then you have to know, okay, what's absolutely essential here? I remember listening, this was like in 2009, I think 2010, interview with Sue Marvin, who was at the time part of the third generation of owners of Marvin Windows and Doors, based in War Road, Minnesota.
A very small town in northern Minnesota.
Yeah, about 2,000 people. Yeah. The factory in War Road is about, I think it's around 2,000 employees. Hmm. Like, they employ as many people as live in the town. And so it's vital to that town's economy. And when the recession in 2008 hit, and especially at the building trades really hard and those manufacturers, their orders declined by 2/3 and just overnight. Their competitors were laying people off. and just really cutting down operations. And she got together with her brothers. This is a story that she was telling, how like they got together and they said, like, we can't do that. We can't just lay off a whole bunch of people in this town. The whole town depends on it. What can we do? So the question then becomes like there's an easy business decision. The tough business decision is, okay, we're going to have to meet with everybody and say, like, we're going to have to compromise on this. They cut hours from 40 to 32. They stop making 401k contributions and reimbursement for education. Like, there's a whole bunch of things, of benefits. They continue health care. They also take no pay themselves. And then gradually over the next like 3 or 4 years, they start reinstituting a lot of those things. But here's the thing. They don't lay off their employees. When orders start coming back, they're able to ramp up, have a huge competitive advantage over their competitors because their competitors have lost all their best people.
And they have to go out and hire new folks and train them.
And they can't be real choosy in who they hire. Like it's not the people that have the same level of experience and everything else. So then they've got quality control issues and everything. Marvin Windows and Doors is ready to go as soon as the orders come in. You have to be able to take the long view. This is a really important trait in leadership, is taking the long view and not making crisis decisions.
And you'll be talking about all of these things later this month. Is that right?
Yep. We have our 23rd annual Servant Leadership Conference coming up here in La Crosse at the end of this month. And we've been, you know, for a number of years, shortly after we started the Servant Leadership Program, we started this annual conference, and it's grown over the years. So now we bring in about 400 people every year for this conference.
And is it filled up this year?
Well, we moved to a new venue. We've got it on our main campus. We used to have another in another place downtown. So we've got a lot of extra capacity this year.
Well, we will certainly put a link to that in the show notes for anybody who's listening and wants to dig into that more.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Scott, what's your question for me?
Rick, it is the summer, and let's say you have some landscaping work that you are doing around your house, and during that process, you've collected a sizable pile of dirt. You don't have any use for it, and your city doesn't have a designated place where residents can dispose of excess soil. On the edge of town, a major construction project has created a massive dirt pile, many thousands of times larger than what you've done in your yard. That dirt is sitting in your pickup truck, and you drive past that big piece of land on the edge of town, and you see that big dirt pile, and you think, my little bit of dirt would just be a drop in the bucket. Would you consider driving up there, you know, kind of at dusk one night, emptying the tailgate, dumping out the dirt, and heading home?
Absolutely not. I think you're right. It probably wouldn't do any harm. Nobody would notice. I'm not going to trespass onto a construction site. That's just not going to happen.
Even if it's just like let's say it's just a field with a big pile of dirt. All they've done is like that. There's not like obvious holes or girders going up in the sky. It's just a field with a pile of dirt.
Yeah. No, I still wouldn't. And because it's somebody else's property. And this is a basic ethical principle. If it's something that you think that you have to do at night, mm-hmm. right, you can't do it. It's because you're not getting consent. Now, if you're absolutely sure they wouldn't mind at all, then you just go ask them in the middle of the day and say, hey, do you mind if I dump some mm-hmm. dirt here? But like, look, you're not going to have any problems getting rid of dirt by just putting a sign in your yard and saying, free dirt. People are going to come and take it.
So I'm not at all surprised you would say that. And I thought you would say that, obviously, if you contacted the person who has that construction site and says, hey, I'm Rick, I have a truckload of dirt, do you mind me coming over there? And it's like, again, not even a pickup load, and he's certainly aware that this is, like, you know, huge. What is the reason that person is going to say no?
Here's why you don't do that.
You mean if you're the owner of the land?
If you're the owner, if you're the owner of the dirt.
Yeah.
Why you don't do it is because you don't know why they might say no.
Well, but
like, there might be reasons that you haven't thought of. Right?
The most likely reason they're going to say no is that if they say, sure, Rick, whenever you want, stop over there. I mean, over the next, you know, month, because after that, we're going to have some heavy equipment going on and we don't want you around. But anytime you want to do it in the next month, go for it. The reason my hunch is the reason that no smart person is going to say that is in that 1 in 500 chance that you're there and something happens and you sprain your ankle or something significantly worse happens while you're doing that, you can then say, well, so-and-so who owns this land said I could be here, and clearly he should have known it wasn't safe for me to be here, so I'm going to take him to court. I mean, that's like the liability issue that no smart landowner is going to want to deal with. But obviously, if you do it at dusk one night and twist your – I mean, obviously, you have nobody to get angry with but yourself. So my take on this is – no, it probably doesn't matter. That probably the only reason the person's not going to want you to be there is they don't want the liability of you being on their property. But if you do it without asking, they had to have no liability. So I think there's little harm done here.
This is the problem with overthinking things, Scott. You just talked yourself into thinking that you're doing the landowner a favor not asking him.
I'm not doing him a favor, but
you're protecting him from liability by not even asking him and just doing what he would be like. No, you ask him, and if he says no,
you say
thank you. Then you figure out another way to
I mean, obviously, like you said, there could be like some reason that the two of us cannot conjure up on this broadcast as to why that's like bad. Like, maybe that dirt is, I can't even think what it would be, but smarter people than us might come up with a reason. But it seems like a really big edge case. And again, if you have this mound of dirt that's like 4 or 5 stories high that covers like, you know, a third of a football field, I mean, and obviously I don't know what your plans are with that dirt, but, you know, adding 0.01% to that is really not going to matter. I mean, at what point does an ethical dilemma, like, does the harm, like, well, the harm you're doing is so little that, I guess, why does that not play into this?
If you are just a convinced consequentialist, like, the only way you evaluate what's wrong and what's right and what's wrong is based on, is there any harm caused or not? Then I would think then you'd be right. But that's not the only consideration. The other consideration is we have certain rules for how we treat one another. And one of the rules is, like, if you own something, I don't get to use it without your consent. Because there could be all kinds of things that I would be able to just use without your consent and not do any damage to them at all.
Okay, but like...
And like your bike is sitting out one day, and mm-hmm. I think I've been thinking about getting a bike like this for myself, and I don't see Scott around. I'm just going to take it for a spin around the block, and it's very unlikely anything's going to happen to it. If something does happen to it, I'll gladly pay to get it fixed, so I'm not doing any harm. Why not do that? And I'm not even, like, it would just bother Scott to, like, knock on his door and ask him, and he probably doesn't want to be disturbed, so I'm just going to take his bike and ride around the block. And you would still think, no, that's wrong, not because it doesn't do any harm, just because it's yours, and I didn't even ask you.
So I know where you live, and so this doesn't quite work there. But let's say you lived in a little more on the edge of town, right? And let's say you had a couple of acres of land. And this isn't like, you know, used for any like agricultural purposes. You mow it. You have some trees and shrubs. But like it's just like 2 acres of your land. And because of where it's positioned, every day you notice a couple of kids cut across your 2 acres of land because, and you kind of know where they live and you know where their school is, and it's like a shortcut to school. Well, they didn't ask you.
Yeah.
Are you going to be like the guy who like opens the door and says, get off my yard, because you should be, there are sidewalks and there's streets or there's other rights of way. And they clearly are like, even though they're like maybe in fourth grade, understand that that's like not a park, that that's clearly your house. And like, why is that okay?
So it's kids.
It doesn't hurt anything. Okay, it's not.
It doesn't
okay,
do anything.
Not, okay, okay. But they're not a kid. It's a 25-year-old going to his factory job across the way.
Yeah, and are generally accepted rules for something like that. We understand how this works. If it really bothers me, if there's some really good reason I don't want people to cut across a corner of my property, I'm going to put up no trespassing signs. Make it really clear
or
they're not welcome.
Or whatever. Yeah.
And then there would be a problem. If I put up a sign saying, I don't want, you know, no trespassing, I don't want anybody cutting across that property, and then you do it anyway, that's not right. But it's generally accepted. Like, we have property. You can, if you're walking across and you're not doing any harm, that's okay. We accept that. That's different than dumping something off. I would say it's like this. Like, there's all kinds of people. For example, if you live in the country, you're familiar with people doing things on your land, dropping things off, and that you'd never agreed to.
Yeah, you see signs that you can like buy at the store that say no dumping.
Yeah, yeah. People will dump off stray cats all the time from the city, like, and they think, oh, I'm not doing any harm. I'm just putting them out in the country, and then they've got these problems of feral cats that they have to deal with on their property, and the person from town is thinking, well, I'm not doing any harm, and plus I'm doing something good. I'm not killing the cat. Our ability to imagine the consequences is often not adequate to the situation. And that's why if like property belongs to somebody else, you have to seek their consent. And if it's very likely they got just a big pile of dirt, they're probably going to say, oh, yeah, go ahead and dump it there. We're like, no problem.
I mean, maybe. But I guess I'll just leave it, and I don't think we're going to agree on this, is that, like, if I, for some whatever reason, had, like, toxic waste and, like, put that in your backyard, we all, like, that's bad. And, like, cutting through your backyard because it saves me 20 minutes to get to my job is, like, not bad at all. And like, I think there is a gradation there of like awful, like probably criminal behavior of dumping toxic waste in your backyard versus like cutting through your yard because it saves me time. And I would argue that my dirt example is much, much, much closer to the cutting through your yard example than it is like toxic waste or some other awful thing. And I feel like it's almost to the side of it almost doesn't matter. Because if the person with a big pile of dirt like was upset with it, they could just put a sign up that says no dumping or no trespassing, and like that sign's not there. So, I mean, you know.
Well, you could. You don't think you have to. I mean, you don't think you have to put up a sign for all the sorts of things that you don't allow on your property, because it's commonly understood. Like, this is my property. You don't put anything there that's going to stay there. You just don't. And so that's why it doesn't matter if it's dirt. It doesn't matter if it's, you think it's relatively benign or it's really harmful. I agree. It's much worse to put toxic waste
there. Yeah, it's
there.
Kind of a ridiculous example, but you know what I'm saying.
But
yeah.
If it's anything, like you don't, like, so I have a piece of paper and I'm just going to toss it in the yard. It's going to biodegrade anyway. It's not going to, like, yeah, you just don't do it.
Well, I'm not surprised this was your answer, but it was, and we probably won't even discuss why this came up as a topic, because that's probably best. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and also be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and it will touch on many of the non-dirt related topics we talked about today, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for joining us.